PMA 213. And you know, I've asked if it's actually about to rush that. I know I'm getting ahead of myself, but that's two flights away. You have a flight going up tomorrow from Cape Canaveral at 4:33 p.m. And that's Dragon's space cargo craft that will be going up and docking with the space station with almost 5,000 pounds worth of stuff. And it really birds to the space station. It goes into the Harmony node, but it, you know, they don't have a docking collar. That's a birthing contraption, a setup that they have. No good for piloted crews, but it's good for cargo. And they'll be doing that in a couple of days. They'll launch tomorrow at 4:33, and it'll take about 2 days for Dragon to get near the space station. The arm will come over and you know, directed by the crew inside the space station, and attach the Dragon to the International Space Station. Interesting flight, because this is going to be another attempt to reuse the booster, the first stage booster. They plan on having a flyback at the launch. Booster eventually burns out after a couple of minutes, separates from the second stage, and the first stage will reorient itself 180 degrees. Has these nitrogen jets to do that. You got to remember they're going now 4,000 miles per hour, and they're actually in space over 60 miles up, and it'll rotate, and then when it's pointing in the right direction to come back, it'll ignite three of the
repeater timeout cancel,
reorient itself again in a downward position, and fire its rockets again to slow itself, you know, toward the water. And then right before it gets to the autonomous drone ship, the barge that SpaceX has floating out there that's big as a football field, it will fire the one rocket that they have left, the Falcon 9, one of the rockets. Each one is called a Merlin D. They've all upgraded their Merlin engines that built by SpaceX, and hopefully it'll land on a barge, and they'll have crews come over. There's nobody on board that barge, and they'll come over other ships and get themselves on deck and lash down the legs, attach the legs to the drone ship, and be able to bring it back. It'll be the first time that they ever do that. His goal is to have reusability. And he's not the only one doing this. There's another company that plans on doing a similar type of thing, but suborbital flights. And it's called Blue Origin. And it's run by Jeff Bezos. He's the CEO of Amazon.com. And he has this company that's been in business for a long time doing the Blue Origin program, and he's been building a spacecraft called New Shepard. He's developed this many years ago. It's called, you know, he had a prototype called the Gonad, and it flew a couple times. Eventually, it crashed. That was many years ago. And now he's come a long way, and he's going to start testing the New Shepard for Blue Origin. He's got new engines attached to it, called the BE-3 engines, and BE-3s have been successfully tested in Stennis down in the rocket test station down in Mississippi, and he's fired these engines a number of times, probably hundreds of times, and he's now going to install them in this suborbital spacecraft that will eventually be manned. He'll be able to even take up a tourist if he wants. test flying it. With that, you know, unmanned test fly it. He's going to test fly it this year, and that should be interesting. You know, they're all competing with each other. You've got many companies that are involved, private companies. It's really like a commercial space race. Let me drop it. Many things that happen in the during the week, from week to week, but just try to highlight the important.
Invented by John Hobart, and he bypassed all the chain of command and went directly to the head of NASA, saying, you got to listen to me. You guys are dedicated to follow Kennedy's orders to do it before the decade is out, the 1960 decade. And when you go through the back of the envelope calculations, you're going to find out that 7.5 million pounds of thrust is probably 5 to 1 too small for the requirement to bring an orbit, to bring an astronaut to the moon and back without using lunar orbit rendezvous. And through a whole bunch of steps like that, John Hopolton, who became a NASA engineer, or maybe was one at the time, invented this technique. And that technique was not well known, and certainly was not well accepted by any of the NASA engineers at the instant that Kennedy made his pronouncement. His best advisors told him that the United States had the resources to do this, and they were probably 5 to 1 wrong, because downrange, this technique was invented. So now we know, you and I are having trouble remembering his name, John Hobolt, H-O-U-B-O-L-T. Does that sound familiar to you, Paul? WS2N-K2LIW?
Last time I remembered his name started with the letter H, but that's the guy. And, in the long run, he got a LEM to land on the moon, not once, but 6 different times, so it worked out pretty good. Each LEM was, 33,000 pounds, and then they had an upgraded one, I think it was 38,000 pounds as time went on, Apollo 15, 16, and 17. So he succeeded. Their biggest worry was docking. Not so much docking. They knew they could do it around Earth orbit because they experimented with the Gemini spacecraft. They actually sent two of those spacecraft up at the same time. They rendezvoused, and in the future they docked using the Agena spacecraft. But, would it work around lunar orbit? Could you launch that, the upper part of the LEM and use the bottom part as a landing launch pad and have that thing dock with the command module? Interesting proposition. But he did sell them on it. It worked out. In fact, he did.
As much as they may have resisted it, they had no choice. When you finally calculated how much booster power you would need, how many pounds of stuff you would be bringing down to that gravity well called moon and bringing it back up, if you didn't do LOR. And yes, it's got the extra risk involved. The first time in Gemini that we tried to do linking in space, it wasn't successful. I mean, common sense would lead you to believe, hey, something's in front of you. It's a mile away. You blast the rocket in the opposite direction, speed up a little bit, and you'll close the 1 mile between you and that object in orbit that's in front of you, another Gemini spacecraft. Good common sense. You blast in that direction, you go a little bit faster, and the orbital mechanics are such that your orbit becomes larger in diameter, and you slow down. So you blasted the rocket in the right direction to close the distance, and for the first 15 minutes or so, the distance is closing. Then by then you've gone a quarter of an orbit, you're at a higher altitude, and that new elliptical orbit you've just created by that blast, you slow down, and the distance between you and the object you want to meet up with increases. You got to do the opposite. You blast the rocket towards the thing you want to go to. At first you're slowing down and the distance is increasing, but very soon, in 15 minutes or so, your orbit is lower and faster. You go under him and ahead of him, and then you reverse the process in order to come back up and link with him. It's a very crazy procedure to do dual orbit linking, link up something else. And so, in order to have a in the case of Apollo 11, with Armstrong and Aldrin on board, come up from the moon, and Collins is sitting in the command module in orbit around the moon. In order for those two to link up, you've got to do all of this orbital mechanics just right. That computer program that was on the lunar module and on the command module had 36 kilobytes of memory. That ain't much of a computer program. With that tiny little computer program, you do all of that orbital calculations to get the right timing, the right orbit inclination, the right orbit altitude, and the right elliptical characteristic of the orbit in order to link up without burning up all your fuel. If Armstrong and Aldrin came back up to the moon, if they didn't link up correctly with the service module with Collins in it, without that link up, those two guys are going to die. Simple as that. Collins still has the option of making the burn that brings him out of lunar orbit back to Earth. But if he doesn't link up with the two astronauts coming up in the lunar module, the upper portion of the lunar module, if he doesn't link up with them and transfer their bodies from the lunar module back into the command module, then those two guys are not going to survive. And so the rocket bringing you up from the moon has had to fire. There's only one of them. And as you probably know, they had broken off one of the switches that did that enable. Let me drop it. So one of these toggle switches got broken off, and Aldrin took out his fountain pen, took out the metal tubing in the fountain pen, stuck it into the socket of where the bat had broken off on that switch, and flipped that switch in order to enable the rocket that would get them back off the moon. I mean, they come very close to running out of fuel on the landing. They come very close to not coming back off the moon. And then even after they did all that, they said the linking up had to be just right, otherwise they're not going to survive. The lunar orbit rendezvous has a whole lot of extra risk to it, but it probably cuts down by something like 5 to 1 the size of the Saturn V required. 7.5 million pounds of thrust. Can you imagine multiplying that by another 5 to do it without lunar orbit rendezvous? We wouldn't have lived long enough to make a booster that big, and because there's a you don't get economy of scale when you're putting a whole lot of really high-power rocket engines together to make, I think there was 5 individual engines, I believe, on the Saturn V to give you that 7.5 million pounds of thrust. Can you imagine adding a whole lot of those engines and make sure that every one of them fired just right? Instead of that vehicle blasting off from Cape Canaveral 365 foot high, it would have been 700 feet high. The risk factors would have been huge. I don't think we would have done it. For all we know, the Soviets didn't have lunar orbit rendezvous with their plan. In theory, they were racing us to the moon. And without lunar orbit rendezvous, they wouldn't have stand a chance. I mean, if we pooled all of our resources, the Soviet Union and the United States, to make a rocket big enough to do it without LOR, there's a doubt as to whether or not we could have done it. That's a bunch of opinions. What do you think about all this, Paul? WS2N, K2RAW?
Even now with the new rocket that NASA's building, the SLS, Space Launch System, that's going to be 10.5 million pounds at launch, at its biggest configuration. Soviets tried it. They were going to have one big shot to the moon. They call it the N1 rocket. It blew up a couple of times. Got off the launch pad, and it didn't work out. Literally 100 rockets attached to this thing, maybe, 50 or 60 at the bottom and another 30 for the second stage, whatever it is. They were all these N-33 rockets, and it was a little taller than the Saturn V, but much wider, I forget the diameter of this thing, and it blew up. They tried a couple of test flights with the N1, and no go. And they were going to be happy. They were going to land the one man on the moon in their manned version, and then take off. And we had two, but it worked out in the end. I mean, Kennedy wanted to land two people on. He actually said land a man on the moon. Wound up doing two before the decade was out, and in reality he did 4 because Apollo 12 went up before the change of the decade. So quite an accomplishment. People put their mind to doing it. That 400,000 people working on the lunar landing program throughout the country. So. Did work out. Now they're going to try to go to Mars. We'll see what happens. I hope we live to see it. This one guy that I mentioned before from Ad Astor, that's the name of his company. He's an astronaut. His name is Franklin Diaz, Dr. Franklin Diaz. Been working on this Vasimir engine for decades, and it's called it's a acronym, Variable Specific Impulse Magnetic Plasma Rocket, and this is the one I was talking about before, and we'll talk about it more in the future, but it's a good design, and he hopes to get people to Mars within 37 days. Back to you, Dick.
Interesting. Space question.
I'll go to West in a minute. The magnetic engine that you just said, magnetic plasma engine, I think that you called it, what does it have by comparison to a chemical engine? What does it have by comparison to an ionic engine? The good news about an ionic engine is that your exhaust velocity is a good fraction of the speed of light. You're getting a hell of a lot of energy, of thrust, out of each pound of stuff that you expel. That's the good news, but the bad news, you get sleep power thrust. A chemical engine gives you a whole lot of thrust, but doesn't have anywhere near the efficiency. And by the way, the efficiency is called specific impulse. So what does this engine you now describe have? Is it midway between those two in thrust, and midway between those two in efficiency, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Oh, it's in between, but it's not midway. It's much closer to the ion version. Ion engine, we talked about that, the weight of a piece of paper. This one, at a 50 kilowatt version, which was many years ago, I think he got 100 times that, 100 or so times more than that pressure. And now he's up to 200 kilowatt version. And I'm using the word watts because to ionize this stuff, he uses RF. So that's why I think it's interesting. Still trying to figure out what frequency he's using, but he's using RF to turn argon into plasma. He could use argon or xenon. For some reason, he's sticking with argon. They're both heavy molecules, so he actually had a plan a while back. NASA accepted it, but then they stopped it. Let me drop it. He was going to attach it to the International Space Station and experiment using it as a boost type of thing. Once he gets this thing developed in the future, you could attach it to a space station and leave it on all the time, or not, you know, most of the time, and you could push the space station and keep it at a higher altitude instead of using all these chemical rockets, which cost I think I read $200 million a year to keep the space station where it is, you know, and fuel and, you know, what's involved to do it. You know, you got a progress ship up there. You know, the average cost is $200 million. This guy could bring it down to what was it? One twentieth of that cost. Back to you, Dick.
Now, 1/20th of the cost to do what? I mean, the majority of the cost of maintaining the International Space Station is the cargo ships bringing up all of the consumable materials, bringing up and bringing back down astronauts, establishing new modules. How is it going to suddenly become cheaper? Just because of the thrust requirements of getting the cargo ships up there? Is that what you're saying, Paul?
Yeah, well, I talked about this a lot with the boosting of the space station. Primarily now it's being done with the Progress spacecraft. Before that, Progress also had some help from the ATV, Automatic Transit Vehicle, by the European Space Agency, which was bigger than the Progress. And these fuelings and rocket firings that they do, you know, keep the space station, you know, always raise the space station. The cost of just doing that, just keeping it at the proper altitude, is around $200 million a year. So if you could hook up this type of ion engine, you could do it for 1/20th of the cost, according to Dr. DSV. And this guy, you know, he's not just a regular old physicist. He is a physicist. He was one first before he was an astronaut. He flew on seven different missions. He's been blasted into space seven different times. So he, you know, with spacewalks and everything else. And each time he went up, if there was a you know, some kind of physics experiment that was going up, he was probably one of the guys that was on that launch back in there.
Well done. Wes, I think you said you had a space question. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Yeah, there's enough questions that I can send to you. I believe Dr. Rui would be available, and John as well. Just a simple question, since we talked about the devices that are being sent to space. As a matter of fact, Rui sent me a link for the new antennas that could be mounted in the microchip, and they use the broken symmetry phenomena. But anyhow, one of the questions is not going to be, we have a little time really talking, I'll let you guys talk. Is it true that in space satellites are not calculated for the resistance of the wire, as everything works in superconductive environment? Maybe just a word first.
Yeah, that doesn't sound right to me. Let's see what Roy's got to say on this. EC2GS, K2RIW, if you're on frequency, Roy, go right ahead.
Yes, I'm on frequency. Can you hear me?
Hearing you very well. And you and I both have to wait a little bit longer to make sure the machine properly resets. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, AC2GS. Yeah, Wes gave me that question, a bunch of questions, and I disagree. Very little, to my knowledge, of superconducting material is used in outer space because, you know, in near solar orbit, the sun screws it up. You'd need a refrigerant to keep it below critical temperature.
Yeah, if I took a chunk of material and I'm floating behind the International Space Station, or I'm floating outside of the space shuttle, and I just let go of this piece of material and it's be exposed to sunlight on one side and cold space on the other side, depending on the color and the reflectivity, it's really called A over E index, semi-second. Absorptivity to emissivity index, depending on the surface characteristics of the material, it's going to settle on some temperature between the two extremes of 3 degrees Kelvin of cold space and some ridiculous number of degrees Kelvin of the material aimed toward the sun. And if I choose the right material, I could have my surface of my spacecraft automatically set itself to 70 degrees Fahrenheit when it's being exposed to the sun. And when you're in orbit around the Earth for a certain period of time, you're behind the Earth, and you're still getting thermal energy from the Earth, not as much. Astronaut can't think of his name right now, the man who did the major repair.
Rory Musgrave.
The man, that's the name I'm looking for. Let me drop it. During the time he was doing that Hubble telescope repair, his hands got so cold that during the nighttime portions of those, let me think now, he was out there for 8 hours, and each orbit is an hour and a half, so approximately six times he was exposed to complete darkness behind the Earth in that orbit when he was repairing the Hubble Space Telescope, and his hands got so cold that he was right at the threshold of getting frostbite. His hands these days have no feeling in their fingers because of that exposure. So most materials, even if you carefully choose a high temperature superconducting material, to my knowledge, the useful materials have to be as cold as something like 100 degrees Kelvin, which is 290 Kelvin approximately is room temperature. It's minus 190 degrees centigrade is probably the temperature you need, at least that cold, if not colder, in order to achieve superconductivity. The superconducting coils that are on the Large Hadron Collider are being boiled at liquid helium temperature at roughly 3 Kelvins, because they need something like 1,000 amperes. I mean, as you put higher current through a so-called superconducting material, at some particular temperature, at some particular current, you lose superconductivity. I forget the name of that threshold characteristic. So in order to get all the superconductivity they need to maintain these super strong magnets on the Large Hadron Collider, everything's running at liquid helium temperature, roughly 3 Kelvin. So can any of the wiring on a spacecraft come anywhere near those temperatures? And yet the human beings a few feet away are not being frozen to death. Very unlikely. So to my knowledge, essentially nothing on the International Space Station is running at superconductivity. I wonder if that's about the way you see it, Roy. AC2GS, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yes, I agree totally. I think it might be of some practical use down the road. But I think it's either not used at all, or if it is, it's very esoteric sensory devices that are very short term, because they probably have a coolant that they run out of rather quickly.
WSLAN.
Yeah, the James Webb Space Telescope, its major focal plane array of detectors, will be running at pretty deep cryogenic temperatures in order to give them the maximum infrared sensitivity. And they're going through heroic things to achieve that. Let me drop. The James Webb Telescope has got, I think it's 5 individual shields, all parallel to each other, in the direction toward the sun and toward the Earth, so that any of the heat coming from sun and Earth has to go through 5 sets of shields before it can get to the hardware on board. The hardware on board, in theory, then, is just being exposed to really cold space, and still, to my knowledge, a combination of Peltier and ebullient heat transfer, in other words, sacrificial fluids like liquid helium, I think are being used to give maximum sensitivity. And I'm a little bit worried that James Webb is going to have its maximum sensitivity only for a small number of years before it uses up that consumable cryogenic fluid, in which case you're now back to just the cold space giving you the cooling of that detector, which is not going to be quite as sensitive. That's my guess on this one, and Paul, bring me up to speed on this one. WS2N, boy, you and I are really looking for James Webb. K2LAW TechNet, you got a ball.
I heard 10 years they expect to have that thing operating before they run into cryogenic problems. But there is a goal, long-term goal of this guy Diaz, in charge of Ad Astra, making the Bessemer engine, to eventually have superconducting coils on his rocket. Because the way this rocket works is, the reason you need 200 kilowatts of power is he's directing the RF, you know, to ionize the gas, but yet he's using magnetic coils to concentrate it so that the plasma doesn't hit the sides of anything on the inside of the rocket. So to increase the power of this thing in the future, he eventually like to develop cryogenic superconducting coils for the Bessemer engine. Back to you.
I'm going to ask for a couple of details on this one now, Paul. He's using RF energy to heat up the fuel material to create a plasma. Plasma really is a conductive substance because you've heated the material to such a high temperature, that's the fourth state of matter, where the electrons leave the nucleuses of those atoms or molecules. And now you've got individual electrically charged negative materials called electrons, and positively charged protons and neutrons, the nucleuses. And the nucleuses have got, I'm guessing, more than 1,000 to 1 more mass than the electrons. Therefore, I'm guessing your coils that are doing the accelerating are doing primarily accelerating of the positively charged particles, because they're 1,000 times more massive than the electron. So it's a positive charged particles that are primarily being squirted out of the back of that rocket engine. And where do the electrons go? You have to do something with them to make sure the whole system doesn't become a huge negatively charged cloud, if you know what I mean. So you can see how Paul, I made a couple of guesses as to what the primary thrust is coming from. I'm guessing it's the positively charged nucleuses of the atoms of the fuel. And once again, what happens to the electrons? WS2N, K2RIW.
The reading I've done on it, it's very, it's way up there in trying to understand what I'm reading. Maybe once they have better websites, they can make it more clear. But it looks like the protons and the electrons, yeah, they're separating from one another, but they're both being blown out of the back of this rocket. And that's the way it looks on the Bessemer engine. It's well worth looking up because it's called a variable specific impulse magnetic plasma rocket, or Bessemer, VASIMR. See if you can make heads or tails out of it. I've been trying to do it. I go from website to website. But that's the way it looks. The advantage is you don't have an anode, a cathode, like you have in your standard ion engines, like you have on Dawn. So there's no cathodes to wear out. And they kind of get in the way, cathodes and anodes, apparently, from what I was reading. And when you have this system, there's nothing in the way. These things just blow out at the back at, 55,000 meters per second. If you could, I guess you could always do the math on that. Back to you, Dick.
Can you go to another one?
Yeah, the 55 meters per second, you and I can now impulse out of that, similar to what we knew with the velocity out of the ionic engine. And I can see...
it's really fast, Dick.
And I can see some advantage of magnetic field acceleration, because I think you now stand the possibility of accelerating both the positively charged and negatively charged components of the fuel. Therefore, you're getting rid of both of them, you're getting thrust out of both of them when you're doing it with magnetic, it's sort of a rail gun. Is that possibly what it is, Paul? You're really building a kind of rail gun for the plasma. I wonder if that's close. In any of the diagrams you've seen, does it look like it's a kind of a rail gun? WS2N, K2RIW.
By the diagrams, I don't say yeah, but it sounds like that. It sounds like it's both being blown out the back. Go ahead, open it, John.
You got it, John.
Dick, wouldn't they need a different magnetic field? Those are two differently charged particles. They'd probably have to switch from negative to positive somehow to project them both out in the same direction.
I think you're right, John. And if you did a negative pulse and get rid of the electrons, second, by the way, a positive pulse first to get rid of the nucleuses, but by alternating the pulse magnitude, the magnetic field, I think you can get rid of both. But you don't want either one to touch the sides, so you have a bit of a conflict. I wonder if Roy has some exposure to this one. AC2GS, K2RIW, go ahead, Roy.
AC2GS, I so much was hoping that you didn't ask me that question. No, it sounds fascinating, and it's got to be much more complicated than simply pulsing positive and negative, because you'd go through 0 points where your ions would hit the side of the engine and destroy it in short order.
I agree with you, Roy, but maybe they've worked out some of those details where the accelerating function and the function to keep the plasma away from the sides are two separate portions of it. Sounds like an awful good way to go. And people have from time to time said, we're going to develop better rocket engines, and maybe this thing, this, I can't even pronounce it, VSIMPR.
Bessemer.
Thank you, Shane.
So Vassimer looks like the better rocket engine. So let's see what Wes wants to add to this. WS2N, N2XJN, K2IW. Go ahead, Wes.
Well, the power has the concept of electricity and magnetism. So, that's the factor there. Now, we're not going to go through all of the questions, but another one. You have a deep space craft, deep space spacecraft, and it's having a transmitter. So, if the battery 12 volt 8 amp hour is powering the same transmitter in your room using 1 amp hour, then how much the transmitter will consume of the power energy from the battery in space, deep space, and again, maybe Roy first.
Oh, boy. Sorry.
AC2GS, yeah. Wes sent me that question. As far as I can see, there's no appreciable difference to the power drain if your transmitter is on the planet Earth or in the vacuum of space, as long as you disallow the temperature fluctuations that could fry a battery and any kind of electronics in space. But I don't think there's any kind of consistent power difference between the two environments, given the same amount of transmitted power, supposedly.
I agree with that. In other words, I've got a transmitter on Earth right now that's, let's say, running 100 watts. I'm putting a 100 volt or 1 ampere into the solid-state transmitter. And it's running at 100% efficiency in my crazy example. And 100 watts of RF energy comes out. You tell me the gain of the antenna, and therefore I know the effective area the antenna has. I therefore know the number of watts per square meter it's emitting. I therefore know how strong the signal is coming out of that antenna. I know how many volts per meter is the E field and the amps per meter of H field coming out of that antenna. I know the frequency it's operating. And the RF energy doesn't give a damn about whether or not it's going through air, vacuum. I mean, that transmitter of known number of watts output on the Voyager spacecraft, 12 billion miles away, works like a charm in a very predictable manner. So it's on board nuclear power supply, or it could be a battery. And if that battery is sitting at room temperature on Earth, or if it's sitting near room temperature on the Voyager spacecraft, the battery would essentially be doing the exact same thing. You gotta be careful on this one. Let me drop this. There are batteries that really don't like being frozen or don't like being boiled. Lithium ion and nickel cadmium and all these other batteries that we use. There's a specific temperature range over which they perform nicely, and you drastically exceed that temperature range and you're going to be unhappy. They don't charge right, they don't discharge right, they don't have as much available energy and so on. So the fact that the radio signal is going through vacuum, the fact that the battery is located in a vacuum, as long as you've got it properly sealed, as long as the battery is at near its right temperature, same thing with the transmitter. I guess most solid-state devices work pretty well down to cryogenic temperatures, but in the other direction, they stop working. You go above 150 degrees centigrade on a silicon transistor, and you drastically cut down its life. So vacuum and cryogenics of space doesn't really change the operation for properly designed batteries, transmitters, and radio signal transmission, antenna, and transmission line. They all continue to keep right on cranking, as I see it, though, Wes. N2XJN, K2IW.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, at first, everything comes to the 1917 Emmy Otter theorem, which means that energy is a translation of symmetry in time. We don't have a time to go to it, and we're not going to go to it, but actually there are few basic rules for everything that goes around. Symmetries. When you look at yourself in the mirror, you see your right hand towards the mirror, your left hand from the mirror is going to go the same way. So the vector will be cancelled. Bottom line is that symmetries are responsible for the conservation of the law. And if we you take the example of rotational symmetry will be then responsible for conservation of angular momentum and translation of XYZ axis will be responsible for linear momentum conservation, and gauge transformation will be charged, which means the gauge of the wire. But anyhow, not going deep into the science. When I was talking about the polarity, there are a few things that are important, and also related to the space. Because the physical law that rules everything have to be ambidextrous, which is left and right-handed, and mirror view is a valid event in the universe, and that space of the polarity, so the polarity has to be conserved. Get about a minute, please.
Yeah, we're down to our last minute before the machine gets cut off. You guys have just listened to TechNet number 1551. Yeah, see, that's one of those symmetric numbers. You can read it backwards and forwards in theory. I forget what they're called. We'll be back next week and settling a little bit more of how radio can be made to work better. Let me think now, what was our major subject tonight? Simply measuring inductors and capacitors. As simple as that sounds, there's a lot going on, and many of the engineers and amateurs when it comes to using extremely simple equipment to confirm the approximate value of an inductor or a capacitor, as you can see, there's more to it than meets the eye. And when it comes to batteries that we discussed quite a bit tonight, lithium ion batteries right now are the be-all end-all, and a high percentage of our portable pieces of equipment are using lithium ion. 2 seconds left, I'm going to pass it over to John, KC2WGB, K2IW, you got it, John, and you guys be kind to each other. You got it, John.
Thank you, Dick. I'd like to thank everyone for dropping in on the net. It's very important, and we get some things, some of the questions get answered in a reasonable amount of time, but KC2WGB, wishing everybody well for the week, and we'll join again next week. Back to you, Dick.
Bye-bye, you all, and see you down the log. As they used to say in California, later, dude.
Dick, it's a palindrome, bud.
1551 is a palindrome. And radar, I think, is one also. And by the way, yeah. No, it's not. But I hear tell Roy that you know radar so well that you can spell it backwards. Is that true?
This is the first time I heard I was a specialist in radar, too.
Why not? If you know how to spell it backwards, you got to be... You know it forwards and backwards. And the word radar, my goodness, has that developed into... having worked in the electronic countermeasures world for 35 years, what used to be called radar in World War II versus what we use today, wow. They've come a long way. Who would ever think a CW radar would give you this very valuable thing called a radio frequency identification tag, which with no battery on board for years on end, you can read it anytime you want to within a 24-foot range and get 96 bits of information out of it. Who would have predicted that? Over to you, Roy.
You'll be wearing one someday.
That is the prediction. You got it, Roy.
Well, that's why I love technology. There's no way that you can predict exactly what the hell is going to happen in 20 years. Nothing could happen, or much more likely, things that none of us could possibly imagine we would need or expect just show up one day. It's incredible to me.
Hey, Roy, what's the name of the man, a famous man, who once said, prediction is very difficult, particularly when it involves the future?
That's a new one on me. I don't know. Who?
I've forgotten, but we'll find out who that was. There's some famous man in history said those words. Bye-bye, you all.
Talk to you soon, Dave. KC2WGB, clear.
Yeah, hi, guys. Just hoping you leave a pause long enough to say hello. N2MB in Rhode Island.
Barry, good evening. Have you seen Rich? Did you make that visit?
Oh, there you go. Okay, it's a little sluggish. Yes, I saw Richie yesterday, and he's doing okay. He's going to be here a while, I think. But it's too long to discuss that one on the radio. I hope this thing sounds okay. It's somebody else's iPad, and I think it's working.
Yes, it's working quite well. All right. So maybe tomorrow, someday down the log, I'll catch you and we'll discuss it. Very good.
There you go. Okay, yeah. We'll discuss it tomorrow. This is a little sluggish, so I sound like I don't know what I'm doing here. Okay, very good. Yeah, I was with him yesterday. We brought him a big hero sandwich and all that stuff, and hopefully he'll be out of there in about a week. That's what we're thinking. It appears that it's possible that he could be out of there in a week, though.
Very good. Well, that's good news. Maybe they adjusted his medications and got everything responding properly now. But, and from what I understand, I think you're ready to make a trip down south, if I remember correctly. So we'll catch up.
Yeah, well, I made a trip this time. I'm in New York right now. Probably about 5 hours traveling time. I'm in Rhode Island tonight, and I'll be back tomorrow. And then within about 2 days, I'm off to South Carolina. And I should be there for about 3 weeks. But we do have EchoLink, so I guess I can still play the game in 2MB.
Okay, Barry. All right. So going down there, and the weather should be very nice by then. A few more days, and should be in the 70s at least for them. So, all right. I'll talk to you soon. KC2WGB.
Okay, and in 2MB. 7-3, guys. I'm going to stand by. In 2MB, Rhode Island.
Well, you're
all right. Are you going to 147?
Okay.
Time is 12:08 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater.
and I can't transmit one of them. Oops.
November 2, Kilo